Well, shall we stand for the reading of the one Bible verse that we have? Deuteronomy 32:43. Sing for joy, nations. Sing for joy, people who belong to him. For he'll avenge the blood of his servants, turn on his adversary, and cleanse both his land and his people. End quote. You may be seated. It's from the International Standard Version. And I thought it was a very encouraging scripture for a time when we have a lot of bad news. This is part 7 of the series on World War II, Wrong or Right. I got a letter this week from a prisoner contact. He is grateful to be on our mailing list, and he wants to, of course, stay on the list. And he sends his thanks and greetings, and he counts it a blessing to be getting the New Covenant Messenger. He writes in part, quote, I have a concern I want to ask about, not just you, but to all your staff, the brothers and sisters who read your message, and all the other ministries and pastors out there. My question is this. Where are y'all at? Where's the white reply to what's going on in the U.S.? Our country, the one we built, the one we founded, the one God led us to, where are all the people who taught me what we believe is the truth and set forth by God? Where's our line in the sand? Where are our applicants for permits to countermarch? Where's our rallies that say white lives matter? Where's our gatherings that teach our children they don't have to be ashamed of being white? Where's our marches that teach our neighborhoods and that the browning of America, mixed marriages and homosexuality, is not just wrong, but is a sin? Why is no one standing up? Why no rallies teaching people how the Jews are destroying the world and Christ's true word? They are taking everything Christian apart. Where are your voices? Where is the pride you speak about? My voice is only so loud here in prison, yet I stand up. In here, everything is in jeopardy, from being locked down in confinement for months to being labeled a gang member, which follows me on a federal level. And once released, I could be injured or killed by the subhumans I live with. Every commercial, every TV show, every new song on the radio, every school class, every BLM march, we lose ground with our children, our future. Where are we when it is needed the most? When it's time to put in the work? Where are we when it is time to answer God's calling? I don't get it. Is this the future we are willing to leave our grandkids? Are we willing to let them be born brown or grow up being gay or married to some minority? Is all that you've preached and taught me for years been for nothing? Why do I feel alone? Please tell me there are folks out there that feel the way I do, that believe in God's truth, that want our history told, that want the white race to prosper. I'd like to end with a quote from one who fought for this truth to her last breath. Quote, a long forgotten wind is starting to blow. Do you hear the approaching thunder? It is that of the awakened Saxon. War is upon the land and the tyrant's blood will flow. End quote, which he quoted from Vicki Weaver. I answered his letter with the following. I understand your concern and why you feel alone. The prophet Elijah thought he was alone too, yet he was not because God had some folk in the background. Yes, there are many out here that feel the same way you do, but the media makes it appear we are alone. Nearly everyone out in the public agrees this is wrong. I have been thinking the same thing. Where is the opposition to this voice of hate against Christianity? first not to be making excuses for the silence in the Christian community, but most of us work for a living while the leftists are being paid from other sources. Second, many of those in Christian Identity are elderly and unable to get out on the street. Third, I have seen some communities respond with protests against the left, but of course, not nearly enough. However, I think the opposition will grow. Lastly, there are hundreds of militia groups across the country, known and unknown, that will oppose any communistic takeover of America. That is some hope if we keep President Trump. However, if he is somehow defeated, then the job of any militia will be far more difficult. There are quite a few commentators speaking out, even some black ones, such as Walter Williams and Candace Owens, and we are grateful for the truth. However, as Christians, we do not take our marching orders from any of them, but from the Lord Jesus Christ. Therefore, the preaching of the whole gospel truth with its racial implications to our people is much more critical. I've wondered, where are the Christians who will stand up to this? I thought of the Christian Coalition organization that is supposed to be politically active, yet they have nothing on their site that indicates any opposition to current situation. You cannot even contact them to ask a question. They appear to be useless because they are compromised as supporters of Israel. The Judeo-Christian churches are useless, at least for now, because they have already accepted the, quote, equality of all myth. Most of them have already betrayed their race by allowing people of color into their congregations and by mixed marriages. Perhaps with all the chaos from the dark races, maybe they will wake up. But until they do, it appears we are alone. Alone except for our God. Quote, be not afraid nor dismayed by reason of this great multitude, for the battle is not yours, but God's. End quote, 2 Chronicles 20:15. So continuing with our topic of World War II, RT's 2018 World War II documentary corrects distortions of Anglo media. This is by Michael Bateman of Russia Insider. And just recently, here in just back there in May of this year, revisionist debates about World War II are raging as the old media hegemony disintegrates, and others have a chance to present their side of the story. On the Russian side, you have the argument that it was the Soviets who did the lion's share of the job and don't get enough credit for it. Ukrainian nationalists argue that they were on the right side in joining Hitler against the evil Bolsheviks. And conservative voices, including in Germany, are arguing that Hitler never wanted a war and that the war was forced on him by England and the U.S., who did want it, and that, among other things, the Holocaust never happened. Of course, we would agree with that, too. RT's documentary film, Division, makes a high-quality contribution to the debate supporting the Russian view. It contains extensive interviews with German historians confirming much of what the Russians are saying. From RT, he quotes, a new RT documentary, Remembrance, examines the revisionist narratives about World War II that have muddied the Soviet Union's role in defeating Nazi Germany and obscured the sacrifices made by its people. Quote, I think World War II has been distorted incredibly by the Anglo-American media, and that's because they wanted to diminish the role of Russia and Stalin, who actually defeated Hitler, you know. It wasn't the United States and Britain that defeated him. It was really Stalin, says Dan Henderson, a U.S. journalist. End of quote and end of this article. Well, of course, the American media would want to diminish the role of Stalin, because they do not want Americans to know what their president did to help Stalin. Roosevelt's lend-lease policy sent billions of dollars worth of aid to Stalin and actually held, held back the U.S. Army to allow the Soviets to take their prize of revenge upon innocent Germans. American aid gave Stalin the upper hand in winning the war. Quoting about the lend-lease from Wikipedia, and I'm going to abbreviate some of these numbers as I read through this. The lend-lease policy, formally titled, quote, "An Act to Promote the Defense of the United States," end quote, was a program under which the United States supplied the United Kingdom and the Commonwealth, Free France, the Republic of China, and later the Soviet Union and other allied nations with food, oil, and materiel between 1941 and August 1945. This included warships and warplanes along with other weaponry. It was signed into law March 11, 1941, and ended September 1945. In general, the aid was free, although some hardware, such as ships, were returned after the war. In return, the U.S. was given leases on army and naval bases in Allied territory during the war. A total of $50 billion, that's equivalent today to $565 billion, a little more, worth of supplies was shipped, or 17% of the total war expenditures of the U.S. In all, $31 billion went to Britain, $11 billion to the Soviet Union, $3 billion to France, nearly $2 billion to China, and the remaining $2.5 billion to the other allies. Reverse lend-lease policies comprise services such as rent on air bases that went to the U.S. and totaled nearly $8 billion. Of this, nearly $7 billion came from the British. The terms provided that the materiel was to be used until returned or destroyed. In practice, very little equipment was returned. Supplies that arrived after the termination date were sold to Britain at a large discount for a little over £1 billion using long-term loans from the United States. Canada's program sent a loan of $1 billion and about $3.5 billion in supplies and services to Britain and others. Lend-lease effectively ended the United States' pretense of neutrality, which had been enshrined in the Neutrality Acts of the 1930s. It was a decisive step away from non-interventionist policy and toward open support for the Allies. Roosevelt's top foreign policy advisor, Harry Hopkins, had effective control over Lend-Lease, making sure it was in alignment with Roosevelt's foreign policy goals. In total, the U.S. deliveries to the USSR through Lend-Lease amounted to $11 billion in materials, over 400,000 Jeeps and trucks, 12,000 armored vehicles, including 7,000 tanks, about 1,000 of which were M3 Lees and 4,000 M4 Shermans, 11,400 aircraft, 4,000 of which were Bell P-39 Cobras, and a little over 1 million tons of food. Wow, that's a lot of stuff. The United States delivered to the Soviet Union from October 1, 1941 to May 31, 1945 the following: 427,000 trucks, 13,000 combat vehicles, 35,000 motorcycles, 2,000 ordnance service vehicles, 2.5 million tons of petroleum products, that's gasoline and oil, or 57% of the high-octane aviation fuel, 4.5 million so tons of foodstuff, canned meat, sugar, flour, salt, etc. Nearly 2,000 steam locomotives, 66 diesel locomotives, nearly 10,000 flat cars, 1,000 dump cars, 120 tank cars, and 35 heavy machinery cars. Provided ordnance, goods, ammunition, artillery shells, mines, assorted explosives, amounted to 53% of total domestic consumption. One item typical of many was a tire plant that was lifted bodily from the Ford Company's River Rouge plant and transferred to the USSR. In total, 92% of the wartime production of railroad equipment by the USSR was supplied by Lend-Lease, which augmented the existing stocks of at least 20,000 locomotives and 500,000 rail cars. Wow, I have a question. Did Rosie the Riveter and other Americans know that their sacrifices during the war helped to build Soviet rail infrastructure? The Soviet Air Force received 18,000 aircraft, which amounted to about 30% of Soviet wartime fighter and bomber production. Most tank units were Soviet-built models, but about 7,000 Lend-Lease tanks, plus more than 5,000 British tanks, were used by the Red Army, 8% of wartime production. According to the Russian historian Boris Vadimovich Sokolov, Lend-Lease had a crucial role in winning the war. Quote, on the whole, the following conclusion can be drawn, that without these Western shipments under Lend-Lease, the Soviet Union not only would not have been able to win the Great Patriotic War, it would not have been able to even oppose the German invaders, since it could not itself produce sufficient quantities of arms and military equipment or adequate supplies of fuel and ammunition. The Soviet authorities were well aware of this dependency on Lend-Lease. Thus, Stalin told Harry Hopkins, that's FDR's emissary to Moscow, that the USSR could not match Germany's might as an occupier of Europe and its resources, end quote. Nikita Khrushchev, having served during the war as military commissar between Stalin and his generals, addressed directly the significance of Lend-Lease aid in his memoirs. Quote, I would like to express my candid opinion about Stalin's views on whether the Red Army and the Soviet Union could have coped with Nazi Germany and survived the war without aid from the United States and Britain. First, I would like to tell about some remarks Stalin made and repeated several times when we were discussing freely among ourselves. He stated bluntly that if the United States had not helped us, we would not have won the war. Emphasis mine. As this is the end of the Wikipedia quotes. It seems very clear that without the help of the West, the Soviet Union could not have taken Germany for the Allied Jewish powers. Flowing right into this, let's take a look at revenge and the Morgenthau Plan. The Morgenthau Plan, following World War II, was a proposal to eliminate Germany's ability to wage war by eliminating its arms industry and the removal or destruction of other key industries basic to military strength. It was first proposed by United States Secretary of the Treasury, Henry Morgenthau, Jr., in a memorandum entitled Suggested Post-Surrender Program for Germany, end quote. It was his dream to dismantle Germany's industry after the war and reduce Germany to a medieval peasant society. He wrote in his diary, page 11, quote, Germany must be turned into a wasteland as happened there during the 30-year war, end quote. Morgenthau also wrote a book, Germany is Our Problem, which described the plan in detail. Eisenhower was an early supporter of the Morgenthau Plan, which would have placed Germany's main industrial areas under international governance, turned over most land to agriculture, and partitioned Germany into separate states. In November 1945, he approved the distribution of 1,000 free copies of Morgenthau's book to American military officials in Germany. The plan was not adopted in one fell swoop, and it faced opposition because of its radical agenda. But most of its principles prevailed in the Second Quebec Conference, that was in September of 1944, a high-level military meeting held in Quebec City. An agreement was reached on a number of matters, including a plan for Germany, based on Morgenthau's original proposal. The memorandum, also referred to as the Morgenthau Plan, drafted by Churchill, provided for, quote, eliminating the war-making industries in the Ruhr and the Saar, looking forward to converting Germany into a country primarily agricultural and pastoral in its character, end quote. However, it no longer included a plan to partition the country into several states. Morgenthau persuaded Roosevelt to write to Secretary of State Cordell Hull and Secretary of War Henry Stimson, saying that a U.S. occupation policy, which anticipated that, quote, Germany is to be restored just as much as the Netherlands or Belgium, quote, was far too lenient. A better policy would have the Germans, quote, fed three times a day with soup from army soup kitchens, end quote. So, quote, they will remember that experience the rest of their lives, end quote. Hull was outraged by Morgenthau's, quote, inconceivable intrusion into foreign policy. Hull told Roosevelt that the plan would inspire last-ditch resistance and cost thousands of American lives. The Republican presidential candidate, Thomas Dewey, complained in his campaign that the Germans had been terrified by the plan into fanatical resistance. Quote, now they are fighting with the frenzy of despair, end quote. Secretary Hull honestly believed that, quote, the Morgenthau plan aimed at the massacre, enslavement, and liquidation of the German people, end quote. From Wikipedia, I'm quoting, Churchill was not inclined to support the proposal, saying, quote, England would be chained to a dead body, end quote. Roosevelt reminded Churchill of Stalin's comments at the Tehran conference and asked, quote, are you going to let Germany produce modern metal furniture? The manufacture of metal furniture can be quickly turned into the manufacture of armament, end quote. The meeting broke up on Churchill's disagreement, but Roosevelt suggested that Morgenthau and White continue to discuss with Lord Cherwell, Churchill's assistant. Cherwell was Jewish. His name was Lindemann. Lord Cherwell has been described as having, quote, an almost pathological hatred for Nazi Germany, and that almost medieval desire for revenge was a part of his character, end quote. Morgenthau is quoted as saying to his staff that, quote, I can't overemphasize how helpful Lord Cherwell was because he could advise how to handle Churchill, end quote. In any case, Cherwell was able to persuade Churchill to change his mind. Churchill later said, quote, at first I was violently opposed to the idea, but the president and Mr. Morgenthau, from whom we had much to ask, were so insistent that in the end we agreed to consider it, end quote. Some have read into the clause, quote, from whom we had much to ask, end quote, that Churchill was bought off, and note a September 15 memo from Roosevelt to Hull stating that, quote, Morgenthau has presented at Quebec, in conjunction with his plan for Germany, a proposal of credits to Britain totaling $6.5 billion, end quote. Hull's comment on this was that, quote, this might suggest to some quid pro quo, with which the Secretary of the Treasury was able to get Mr. Churchill's adherence to his cataclysmic plan for Germany, end quote. He could either accept the Jewish plan for revenge, along with the loan, or announce bankruptcy for Britain. At Quebec, White made sure that Lord Cherwell understood that economic aid to Britain was dependent on British approval of the plan. During the signing of the plan, which coincided with the signing of a loan agreement, President Roosevelt proposed that they sign the plan first. This prompted Churchill to exclaim, quote, "What do you want me to do? Get on my hind legs and beg like Fala?" Fala was Roosevelt's dog. End quote. Hull argued that nothing would be left to Germany but land, and only 60% of the Germans could live off the land, meaning 40% of the population would die. Stimson expressed his opposition even more forcefully to Roosevelt. According to Stimson, the president said that he just wanted to help Britain get a share of the Ruhr and denied that he intended to fully industrialize Germany, deindustrialized. Stimson replied, quote, "Mr. President, I don't like you to dissemble to me," quote, and read back to Roosevelt what he had signed. Struck by this, Roosevelt said he had, quote, "no idea how he could have initialed this," end quote. The theory that Roosevelt was not truly rejecting the plan is supported by Eleanor Roosevelt, who stated that she never heard him disagree with the basics of the plan, and who believed that, quote, "the repercussions brought about by the press stories made him feel that it was wise to abandon any final solution at that time," end quote. But other sources suggest that Roosevelt, quote, "had not realized the devastating nature of the program he had initialed," end quote. On May 10, 1945, President Truman approved the Joint Chiefs of Staff Policy 1067, which directed the U.S. forces of occupation in Germany to, quote, "take no steps looking toward the economic rehabilitation of Germany, nor steps designed to maintain or strengthen the German economy," end quote, from Wikipedia. In January 1946, the Allied Control Council set the foundation of the future German economy by putting a cap on steel production. The maximum allowed was set about 25% of pre-war production level. Steel plants not needed were dismantled. Because of the Potsdam Conference, all occupation forces were obligated to ensure that German standards of living could not exceed the average level of the European neighbors with which it had been at war. Germany was to be reduced to the standard of life it had known in 1932. The first level of industry plan signed in 1946 stated that German heavy industry was to be lowered to 50% of its 1938 levels by the closing of 1,500 manufacturing plants. The problems brought on by these types of policies were eventually apparent to most U.S. officials in Germany. Germany had long been the industrial giant of Europe, and its poverty held back European prosperity. The poverty in Germany also led to extra expense for the occupying powers, which were obligated to make up the most important shortages through the Gariola program, that stands for Government and Relief in Occupied Areas. With the continued poverty in Europe and the beginning of the Cold War, it was important not to lose all of Germany to the communists. General Clay stated, quote, "there is no choice between being a communist on 1,500 calories a day and a believer in democracy on 1,000, end quote. It was clear that a change in policy was required. On September 6, 1946, the change came by, quote, "restatement of policy on Germany," end quote, a famous speech by James Burns, U.S. Secretary of State, held in Stuttgart. also known as the Speech of Hope. It set the tone of future U.S. policy as it repudiated the Morgenthau economic policies. Economic reconstruction gave the Germans hope for the future. After lobbying by the Joint Chiefs of Staff and Generals Clay and Marshall, the Truman administration realized that economic recovery in Europe could not go forward without the reconstruction of the German industrial base on which it had previously been dependent. In July 1947, Truman rescinded on, quote, national security grounds, end quote, the punitive Joint Chiefs of Staff's 1067, which had directed the U.S. occupation forces in Germany to, quote, take no steps looking toward the economic rehabilitation of Germany, end quote. JCS 1067 had been in effect for over 2 years. It was replaced by the JCS 1779, which instead stressed, quote, an orderly, prosperous Europe requires the economic contributions of a stable and productive Germany, end quote. The most notable example of this change of policy was a plan established by U.S. Secretary of State George Marshall. The European Recovery Program, better known as the Marshall Plan, which in the form of loans instead of the free aid received by other nations, was extended to also include West Germany. The Morgenthau boys resigned en masse when JCS 1779 was approved. But before they went, the Morgenthau followers in the decartelization division of the OMGUS, which stands for Office of Military Government of the U.S., accomplished one last task in the spring of 1947, the destruction of the old German banking system. By breaking the relationship between German banks, they cut off the flow of credit between them, limiting them to short-term financing only. This prevented the rehabilitation of German industry and had immediate adverse effects on the economy in the U.S. occupation zone. Leave it to Jews to sabotage something. With the currency reform of 1948, Germany eventually recovered. Now this gets right into time of the century that I was born. Thus, while the original Morgenthau plan was never totally adopted in its original form, its basic principles were fulfilled in stages. Next, let's take a look at Jewish revenge. Were the Americans, in fact, the real victors of World War II? And were we the liberators? On May 9th, 1945, that's the day after the German surrender, Jewish revenge was turned loose upon Europe. Eisenhower announced, quote, we are not coming here as liberators, but as conquerors, end quote. The pro-red Richard Scandrett, one of the members of the American Reparations Commission, laid out the supposed, quote, peace for Germany. His account was recorded in the Congressional Records, June 7, 1945, and I quote from those records, Germany will not exist any longer. Only German provinces under Russian, American, or British colonial governments. The living standards will be lowered to the level of the concentration camps and exile territories of Siberia. All classes of Germans will be ruthlessly forced down to the same level. As a final solution, these territories will be governed by a reparations committee of the United Nations, and this committee will decide how many Germans are needed in each of the provinces to secure the standard of minimum agricultural production. All German males not needed for this scheme are to be conscripted into compulsory labor battalions and sent to America or Soviet Russia, especially to those regions of Russia destroyed during the war. No regard is to be paid in the enslavement to the education, family connections, or dependent wives or children of the German deportees. No exemptions to be made of the clergy either. Full understanding was reached between America and the USSR regarding the question of religion in Eastern Europe. The Russian Orthodox Church, after regaining the favor of the Kremlin, will be the official religion in the Baltic republics, Poland, Eastern Germany, Romania, Bulgaria, and Hungary. The Roman Catholics will be cut off from Rome. The Society for the Prevention of World War III, the most fanatically Old Testament organization of Morgenthau, especially demanded that the revengeful clause relating to the dismembering of Germany be carried out. All Germans should be expelled from neutral countries. American businessmen should be given no visa to visit Germany. For the next 25 years, no German person may receive any visa to visit America. Marriage with German women is to be forbidden, and German women may not enter the USA. Postal communication with Germany is not to be restored. End quote. And this quote is from The World Conquerors by Marshenko, 1958. In the wake of advancing American forces, a sinister fifth column followed, the members of which, in 99% of cases, were not Americans. This vengeful army was made up of immigrants from Eastern European countries, of black market operators from Brooklyn ghettos, of Czech, Polish, and Hungarian Jews who took refuge in London, and of criminals liberated from the concentration camps. They filled all posts in the CIC, and that's the CIC is the Counterintelligence Corps of the U.S. Army, organized to, according to the Morgenthau Plan. They swarmed the OSS, that's the Office of Strategic Services, and it's the predecessor of the CIA, in various commissions searching for war criminals, as well as in American security organizations. They became mayors of German towns and commandants of POW camps. They administered La Guardia's UNRRA, that stands for United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Administration. They occupied key positions in the American forces and exercised control over them. There were only 2,524 German war criminals on the original list of the UN, but soon the CIC and the Americans were conducting a search for 1 million German war criminals. Quote, at first, the Soviets wanted to shoot 50,000 Germans summarily, and then they proposed to bring 200,000, quote, war criminals to trial at Nuremberg. A mass of several hundred thousand released from the concentration camps surged towards Poland, Hungary, Romania, and Yugoslavia to become officers in the communist police forces and other terror organizations. They were welcomed with open arms by the Soviet MVD, that's the Ministry of Internal Affairs, who was in control of Eastern European countries. The pattern was the same everywhere. In the forefront, there was an American, a Soviet, or a French general, but in each case, a Jewish deputy dogged his heels. In the refugee camps, these Jews were the chief caterers for UNRRA, as well as the privileged beneficiaries of this relief. Thus, they snatched the best rations from Poles, Ukrainians, and Czechs, their former fellow prisoners in the concentration camps. At the same time, on the roads, military policemen overturned cans of milk to deprive German children and hospital patients of their diet. In German cities, working-class families were turned out of their homes by the tens of thousands, thus rendering vacant the best dwellings. The victims had to leave behind everything, furniture, kitchen equipment, clothing, and even linen, thus forcing the German people to recompense three times over in the form of reparations the actual value of the goods confiscated from the Jews. Uniformed Zionist guards were posted at camp gates, and at first even the military police of the American army could not enter Jewish camps. Those who rounded up, quote, war criminals by the thousands and tortured both guilty and innocent in their jails were almost exclusively Jews. The commandants, captains, and secret agents in the jails at Salzburg and other places, as well as in the notorious Marcus camp, were almost without exceptions Jews dressed in American uniforms. According to a Yugoslav refugee who had been in the camp at Klagenfurt, its British commandant, who handed over war criminals, proudly put a notice on his desk with the inscription, "I am a Jew." The caves and abandoned trenches of Slovenia were utilized as common graves. Vlasov is a symbolic figure in this great slaughter of millions. He was the last person capable of rallying an army of several million men under his flag against Stalin's dictatorship. Naturally, this symbolic personality was handed over by the Western democracies to the Bolshevik regime. Lavrenti Beria, he was a Jew, was given the pleasing task of organizing Vlasov's public execution in Moscow. It was not Nazism that had to be liquidated now, but the leaders of the Christian nations, regardless of political party or creed. To all these things, hypocrites can retort, "Well, after all, this is what total war is all about," end quote. But nobody could explain away, by referring to total war, what happened in Czechoslovakia on the day of the armistice, when the last Wehrmacht units left Prague. Jewish communists, led by Slansky Salzman, returned from Moscow to the Czech capital, where they proceeded to gather the revengeful ex-prisoners of Germany's concentration camps. Quote, "The Czech communists made very clever use of those unfortunate Jews," end quote, wrote Vilag on March 15, 1953, quote, "who came out of the extermination camps half dead. They put the Jews in charge of the expatriation of Sudeten Germans and Hungarians. The idea was not new, as Lavrenti Beria did the same when he used Polish and Ukrainian Jews to hunt down the Ukrainian and Polish anti-Semites, that is, those who could be supposed to have collaborated with the Nazis," end quote, from page 119 of that book. Moreover, because they believed that this supposition could be extended to include nearly everybody, they began a campaign of revenge unprecedented in the history of mankind. Quote, 600,000 Sudeten Germans were killed during the massacres in the earthly hell of the death camps of Czechoslovakia. The Sudeten German white paper records these horrors in full details on more than 1,000 pages, horrors for which there is no precedent in the history of mankind. Armed Czech women and Jewesses continued hitting the womb of expectant mothers with truncheons, that's police batons, until a miscarriage followed. And in one single camp, 10 German women died daily in this way. That's in document number 6. In another camp, the inmates were forced to lick up the bespattered brains of their fellow prisoners who had been beaten to death. German prisoners were forced to lick up infectious feces from the underwear of their fellow prisoners suffering from dysentery. That's in document number 17. The Czech and Jewish doctors refused all medical aid to German women raped by the Russians. Hundreds of thousands died by these means or sought salvation in suicide. As, for instance, in Brunn, where on a single day, 275 women committed suicide. End quote from page 120 of Marshako's book. Naturally, the Western politically correct press, American radio, and the BBC saw to it never to mention these facts, although they, in the first place, were responsible for this campaign of revenge. The unfortunate nation of Hungary, even in its dismembered state, after the Paris Peace Conference treaties, 1919-20, had provided 560,000 Jews with peaceful and safe homes. Hungary did not take vengeance on Jewry even after the first communist dictatorship of Bela Kun, despite the fact that Jews almost exclusively were the commissars and leaders of this communist regime. Concerning Hungary, quote, during the era between the two world wars, 1 million acres were owned by Jews out of the total of 9 million acres of arable land. A Jewish minority of 6% possessed 51% of house property in Budapest, 30% of the total national income, and 25% of the total national assets. When, after the German occupation, the state authorities listed the property and assets of Jewry, amassed in less than 100 years, it was estimated that it possessed the equivalent of 19 wagon loads of gold, silver, and jewels. Whilst the total gold reserve of the Hungarian National Bank could have been loaded into 12 wagons easily. Later, the American authorities returned all this amassed wealth to Jewry, end quote, from page 121. The true war criminals, that's the Jews, had a foreboding that one day they might be called upon to render an account for what they had done in planning the war, as well as for its barbarism. They had to produce an even greater criminal. To justify their revenge, they had to find something more horrible than the 300,000 dead bodies of Dresden or of Caton Wood murders or of the massacres of Bromberg, which could be used as an eyewash to mislead public opinion. A special technique of psychological terror had to be used to cover up all of this. If anyone, even a bishop or cardinal, tried to raise a word of protest and state the truth, he was silenced with the threat of Nazi. Perhaps he was also threatened with being handed over to the Russians. Thus, not only the Germans, but all of Europe was intimidated. Thus, a stage was reached when nobody dared to tell the truth for fear of appearing to defend murder and other atrocities. Quote, the foul propaganda campaign brought about a state of affairs in which the lie appeared as the truth, revenge as administration of justice, and a truthful utterance as condoning war crimes. This propaganda tried to convince the ill-informed Gentile masses that the Jews were the only victims of the war and that no other nations suffered any losses. It remained silent about the common graves dug for millions of Gentile victims, and not a word was said about the massacred Hungarians, Romanians, Bulgarians, and French men. At the same time, the story of Jewry's sufferings was exaggerated beyond all measure, end quote, from the book by Marshenko, page 127. A new age had now dawned in which Jewry could escape the consequences of any deed, and the whole of Christian Europe became a happy hunting ground for Jewry's revenge. It was enough to speak Hungarian in the streets of Munich to be immediately picked up by the military police, whom the Jews promptly called in, and handed over to the communist hangman. Thus an atmosphere was created in which the Allied military authorities became unable to check Jewry's vengeful excesses, and their own existence was jeopardized if they showed any reluctance to offer themselves as pawns for Jewish aims. My conclusion. With the fall of the Third Reich, so Europe fell under Jewish occupation. Everything that had belonged to Europe for 2,000 years had now disintegrated. The Avengers continued doing, only more cruelly, the very things they had claimed Hitler did. Does this not sound like the Democrats today in their attacks on Trump? No matter what he does, it is wrong in their eyes. This occupation of Europe was not an American justice, but was a victorious Jewish nationalism burning with hate and revenge. Holding key positions, they were able to punish everyone, innocent or guilty. In their eyes, there was only one crime, to have opposed or to be in a position to oppose Jewish nationalism. And they cried with a loud voice, saying, "How long, O Lord, holy and true, dost thou not judge and avenge our blood on them that dwell on the earth?" And quote Revelation 6, verse 10. Recompense is God's great function in the world. Quote, "To me belongeth vengeance and recompense," end quote, Deuteronomy 32:35. And evil, however long it may triumph, must one day be dealt with. Before the universe, God will pledge himself by the most solemn oath to bring down his enemies and the enemies of his people. There are few more impressive passages in Scripture than this. Quote, "I solemnly swear to heaven, I say, as certainly as I'm alive and living forever, I'll whet my shining sword with my hands in firm grasp of judgment. I'll show vengeance on my adversary and repay those who keep on hating me. I'll make my arrows drunk with blood. My sword will devour flesh along with the blood of the slain, and I'll take the enemy leaders captive." End quote from Deuteronomy 32:40-42. The poet, Song of Moses in Deuteronomy 32, leaves his people with this great vision of judgment. For them it was necessary to be assured that Yahweh reigns and that evil could not ultimately prosper. With their view dominated by this figure of the ever-living and avenging God, their faith in the moral government of his kingdom would restore them. The poem closes with a stanza, which was our opening scripture, in which the seer and singer calls upon the nations to rejoice because of God's people. Quote, "Sing for joy, nations," and that's nations of Israel. "Sing for joy, people who belong to him, for he'll avenge the blood of his servants, turn on his adversary, and cleanse both his land and his people." Deuteronomy 32:43. The deliverance worked for them will be so great that even the heathen who see it must rejoice. All will see his justice and faithfulness. To be continued.